The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities,
celebrating 50 years of excellence.
Kennedy Bosire is from Kenya, a place where people speak quite a lot of languages.
Yes, Ekegusi is my first language.
Ekegusi, that's what he said, also known as Kisi. Have you heard of it? I hadn't until recently. But it's actually quite widely spoken by about 2 million people. And Kenya is chock full of these tribal languages. Pretty much everyone speaks one or other of them, as well as Swahili, often English too. But Kenyans, like Kennedy, they speak their tribal language at home, not at work, not at school.
I remember when I went to secondary school, it was criminal. I mean, it was not allowed to speak in Ekegusi.
Not proper, not polite.
You will be punished for it if you are found speaking in your vernacular.
How would you be punished?
Maybe by some you will be caned, you know, corporal punishment.
Caned for speaking a language. Kennedy was in a park in Nairobi as he was telling me this. I was in Boston in a studio. My pal Andrea Crossan from the World Radio Program, she was standing next to Kennedy with a microphone. That's how we were talking. I asked Kennedy if kids still get punished if they speak Ekegusi in school. He said, yeah, it's as bad as ever in some places. He and a colleague saw it firsthand recently.
We did visit some secondary school and we found a lady wearing some kind of sack.
A sack like a robe that covered all her clothes. And there was something written on it.
It was written, shame on you for having been heard speaking Ekegusi. The whole day you wear it and everybody else knew why you were wearing it.
Over the years, Kennedy has witnessed many such humiliations. You hear it in the matter-of-fact way he tells these stories. At some point along the way, he decided he had to do something for his mother tongue.
Because of my passion, I would ask much more than my siblings could. And I think that's where all the interest sprang from.
We'll have more on what Kennedy did and is still doing in a few minutes. But before that, the Mohawks and their language. So only a few thousand people speak Mohawk. It's way ahead of Ekegusi in the extinction stakes. But in some ways, Mohawk is also ahead in how the language is being cared for. Mohawk Nation straddles Canada and the US, upstate New York. And for more than a century, both governments forcibly sent Mohawk kids to English-only boarding schools. It decimated the language. But then, a few decades ago, members of the Mohawk tribe on the U.S. side created a school of their own where kids learned in Mohawk. Schools like this, there are dozens of them now, dotted around Indian country. But this one, it was one of the very first in the U.S. Alina Simone visited.
It's a Friday morning ritual at the Akwesasne Freedom School. Some 65 teachers and kids, sporting a mixture of headdresses and hoodies, form a circle and make their way around the room to the beat of a water drum, chanting in native Mohawk. They always begin with this song, Standing Quiver, a tribute to hunters. It's a social song, not a ceremonial one, which is why I'm allowed to tape it. A lot of reservation schools maintain traditions like these, but when the drum stops beating, the kids go back to class and back to speaking English. But here at Akwesasne, English is the foreign language.
You hear that in the words, and then the A-H is an ah sound.
This is Kahetante, one of Akwesasne's phonics teachers.
And we've been working on these sound charts since August to get it perfect before we can go into the actual incorporating and conjugating of the words.
They also have to find creative ways to adapt ancient words to a very modern world.
How do you say monopoly in Mohawk?
Money. There's a lot of money involved, so we just called it the swista, you know, because owista is money. But they have to use all the words in Mohawk.
Like many other teachers at the school, Kahetante is a native speaker of Mohawk, which is unusual among tribes of the East Coast. But the remoteness of the St. Regis Reservation, which sprawls from New York State across a necklace of islands and into Canada, has made the Mohawk more resistant to assimilation, like when agents from native boarding schools on both sides of the border came for their children.
The government schools are constantly being built. We bring them in, clean them up, and start them on their way to civilization.
So it was common just for people, not within the family, but the Indian agent or an official of the government to come into the home and say, we're taking your children because it's obvious to us you can't take care of them.
This is Kaya Tahente, an upper-level teacher at the Freedom School.
And my father didn't go because his father told the authorities that they could take care of him.
But today they all speak English and some have taken business courses, home economics, and other higher training.
The Freedom School inverts the practices of those institutions, boarding schools where traditional clothing, rituals, and native languages were banned, by putting Mohawk first.
We're not just teaching you to be a Mohawk who thinks like the outside system, but thinks in Mohawk. We're teaching our students to be Mohawks and to speak from the Mohawk perspective.
Yagotni Gona Osta, known by her nickname Peachy, was an early teacher at the Freedom School, which she also helped found in the late 70s, a decade when enrollment in Native American boarding schools was at its peak. During this time, from 1979 to 1980, the reservation was in tumult, locked in an armed standoff against the U.S. government and divided against itself over what began as a dispute over building a fence around the U.S. side of the reservation. Parents began to question busing their kids past roadblocks to state schools off the reservation.
I think there was like 25 of us that used to sit in a group and figure out how are we going to start a school.
Meanwhile, members on the Canadian side had recently created a new school called the Ganawage Survival School as a means of literally ensuring the Mohawk language and culture survived. Suddenly, Peachy and her group had a new model.
There were women that were here that were helping us protest that were from Ganawage, and they were like, we can do this. Don't be afraid to do this. And so people took their kids out of school and we started the school.
Mohawk language was just part of the curriculum at first. The decision to go full immersion only came 5 years later, and it was a bittersweet moment for Peachy.
Well, I was one of the teachers, and I don't speak Mohawk. I have a very small vocabulary in Mohawk. There were several of us that didn't speak Mohawk because we were brought up in the public school system, which doesn't teach Mohawk. So in the beginning, that's what we had, is a lot of English. And there was Mohawk language being taught all the time, but it wasn't all day. It was a heartbreak, actually, for us to make that decision to go totally immersion, because I knew that I wouldn't have a place here to teach anymore.
Ultimately, as a parent, most of Peachy's 10 children are graduates of the Freedom School. She agreed with the decision to make it a Mohawk-only speaking school, even though it did mean giving up her job.
The Aguasasne Freedom School, the word freedom in there, has to do with the freedom to think. And to be able to think, you need to be able to understand the language. And so that's why, for us English speakers, for our children, we think that we should push that the language be number one.
Today, there's a language gap between members of Peachy's generation and the younger graduates of the Freedom School, one that students must grapple with.
No, my parents don't speak Mohawk.
Tahua Nizawete is 17 and started attending the Freedom School when he was 3.
I have some aunts and uncles that speak Mohawk, but not my parents.
Today, he says he's almost fluent, but just maintaining fluency outside school can be a struggle.
It's hard because it's not, like, you don't hear it a lot in common culture. So every time you leave, then it's usually all in English.
Remember, Mohawk is still an endangered language, spoken by a minority of the tribe.
But it makes me want to help for more people to be able to speak.
After he graduates, he already has plans to return, this time as a teacher.
Alina Simone. So, the Mohawks haven't exactly had the best of relations with Washington, even after the U.S. reversed its policy of trying to eradicate Native American languages. And there are similarities in Kenya, too. But the thing there, with Ekagusi and some of the other Native languages, is that tribes aren't a tiny minority. Everyone's in a tribe. And that affects how people feel about certain languages. Listen to this guy explain it. His name is Daniel Heber.
I was told the first time I went to Kenya that it's considered rude to ask someone what tribe they're from. People are very sensitive to, you know, the fact that there are these tribal politics and tribal politics exist.
So come election time, people vote with their tribe, most of them anyway. But that's it. After the vote, no talking. And there's good reason. 10 years ago, after a national election, things got seriously out of hand. The election was close. Ethnic tensions were running especially high. There were riots. More than 1,100 people were killed. So you can see why some Kenyans wouldn't exactly be jumping for joy at the idea of a tribe trying to get more recognition for their language. Could be divisive, right?
Yeah, I can see that's also another reason why the government just may really not be comfortable talking about this. And so recognizing these different languages forces, you know, people all throughout the country to really come face to face for that.
And face to face, possibly in different languages. Kenya has more than 60 tribal languages. That guy talking, by the way, Daniel Heber, he's a linguistics grad student at UC Santa Barbara, and he lived in Kenya for a while a few years back. And while he was there, he helped Kennedy Bosire with some Ekagusi language projects. Kennedy has actually had success getting Ekagusi back into some schools as a language of instruction. And he's managed to convince some members of Kenya's parliament that it's okay. It wouldn't result in riots or the breakup of the nation or anything like that. But yeah, he says, some politicians are really worried about bringing back indigenous languages.
But I'll tell you, Patrick, it's not languages which divide communities. Our neighbor, Somali, they speak one language, Somali.
And look at the endless violence there. Rwanda too, he says. They had a genocide. The killers and the people they killed, they all spoke the same language. If I want to think ill of you, I can do it in any language.
I can still think ill of you in English. I mean, I can think ill of you in Swahili. It's not necessary that I think ill of you and plan ill of you in my mother tongue only.
Okay, it's high time you hear what that mother tongue, Ekagusi, what it sounds like. These are three women in a village. Their conversation sounds totally natural. But if you leave the villages for cities, and if you eavesdrop on Ekagusi kids instead of adults, you're much less likely to hear the language. Kennedy is working on that. Because a lot of parents aren't passing Ekagusi onto their kids, he needed to come up with something else that would. He enlisted the help of tribal leaders in Kenya and linguists in the United States and started to work on Ekagusi's first online dictionary. He finished the first edition in 2013.
The schools have bought copies of the dictionary. The dictionaries are in libraries and they're in people's homes. And the people are saying, hey, when are we doing the second edition?
There's that to come, also an online encyclopedia and more.
We want to do it, an app for it, so that users can have it on their mobile phones.
Kennedy doesn't have it all his way, even in his own home. His family live in Mombasa, a big, multicultural, multilingual city, which makes Ekagusi not very useful. He and his wife speak it, and they try to encourage their sons to, but their Ekagusi is so-so. They only really need it when Kennedy takes them back to the family's home village. Still, I spoke to a few people who know Kennedy, and they say he's hardcore. He's going to fight for the language his whole life.
I have to say, in my experience, the individuals that lead these movements are really important.
This is Daniel Heber again, the linguistics grad student.
They're the ones that have this vision of wanting to recapture the cultural heritage in a way that other people, not necessarily that they don't share that vision, but maybe they thought it wasn't possible anymore. It just, like, you know, was so unlikely that it's kind of wishful thinking. I mean, I look at Kennedy, and there wasn't really a dictionary of Ekagusi before he came along. And between him and a small team of elders that they would consult for words, they put together a 14,000 word dictionary in the course of a handful of years. I mean, that is a huge accomplishment.
A I sometimes reach the end of these stories about people trying to save languages, and I end up worrying, am I conveying too rosy a picture? Sometimes it's the opposite, and I ask myself, is all the doom and gloom justified? Who knows with Ekagusi, with Mohawk? No one knows. We're in uncharted territory. In the past, efforts to revive languages have failed, yes, but circumstances are different now. More people value these languages. Governments and the greater community, they can be more supportive. There's a much larger body of research about what works, what doesn't. There's technology, and there's networking like never before. People help each other. So here I am, sounding sunny again, just like Kennedy.
People come up and say, how did you do it here? How did you go about this? And that's really encouraging to us.
Yeah, you sound quite optimistic.
Yes, we are optimistic, Patrick.
There's one last thing here to say about these languages. Mohawk is alive despite the US government. Ekagusi may be kept alive with the help of the US government. This is soft power at its softest. US universities that receive public funding, sending linguistics professors and grad students to Kenya. Also bringing Kennedy Bosire to the US to speak at conferences and to network, to leverage more support for his efforts. Super soft power. There's no America first thinking behind any of this. No deal that creates jobs for Americans. No quantifiable value at all. No nothing. Except that a language many thousands of miles from the US may have a fighting chance at survival, which may help linguists and language activists learn just a little bit more about how all this stuff works, this language revitalization business. And that just may, one day, help languages here in the US, languages like Mohawk. That's it. Okay, that's it for today. There's a great picture of Kennedy that another pal of the pod, Marco Werman, snapped for us in Nairobi. Also, there's video of those village women chatting in Ekagusi. They're all at pri.org/language. Thanks to Daniel Heber for the video. Today's episode was edited by Nina Porzuki. It was mixed by Tina Toby and me. Thanks to Carol Zoll for initial research on both Ekagusi and Mohawk. The World in Words is a production of PRI's The World. We're on Facebook, also on Twitter, at LingoPod. I'm at Patricox, PatriCox. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.
The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities,
celebrating 50 years of excellence.